Te reo ererangi o te mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora anō, Bookends listeners. Here we are. It's another Tuesday and another fabulous show we have got for you this week. I got to interview the marvellous Lucy O'Hagan about her book More Than the Medicine, and it is exceptional, and it's been getting a lot of chat about how to bring the soul into professional practice as a GP, but actually any professional practice working with humanity. It's a book that's full of soul, and I loved interviewing her. So that's my contribution to this week's show. Morin, over to you.
Well, I have two exceptional books too, but couldn't be more different. First of all, Elizabeth Knox, our beloved adult and young adult writer, has written another young adult novel, and it's a part of the Dreamland series, although, you know, I think it's loosely a series, but it's set in that world. It's a fantasy novel. It's what they call calling dark academia.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'd have gothic.
Well, very gothic, absolutely. And then the other book that I'm talking about is, again, it's a non-fiction book. It's written by Australian academic Trish Fitzsimons, who has done an amazing collaboration with an American academic and curator and dress historian, Madeline Shaw, to look at the history of how wool has been affected by war over the years. And it's called, very aptly, Fleeced.
Fantastic. Well, let's have a listen.
Fleeced, Unravelling the History of Wool and War, is the outcome of a very fruitful collaboration between Australian documentary maker and exhibition curator Trish Fitzsimons, who's also an adjunct professor at Griffith University in Brisbane, and Madeline Shaw, who is a curator and author who specialises in the exploration of American culture and history, especially through textiles and dress. She's joining us from Rhode Island, so this is truly an international interview, one of the first I've done, I think, from people from three different continents, if I can call Aotearoa a continent. I think we need to start first, Trish, maybe if you could tell me how you came across Madeline and her work and how this whole thing evolved.
Morin, the last time I told this story, somebody from the audience said, stalker! And I said, no. But in 2014, I flew to the US with my husband, Gary, reading letters that my grandfather had written to my great-grandparents about learning to be a wool buyer. And there were some documents that are about the politics of wool in wartime that kind of got piqued my interest. Then Gary and I happened into the fabulous exhibition, Homefront and Battlefield, that Madeline had done in the New York City Historical Museum. It was full of stuff that just absolutely fascinated me. I had to meet this woman. So we went to Lowell in Massachusetts to get the book. I then didn't stalk, just persistently made it known that I needed to meet Madeline. And she and I had lunch, and the rest, as they say, is book history.
How did you know that it was going to be a book, though? Because I'm always intrigued about that. There's exhibitions, there's collaborations. Madeline, when did you think a book might be the outcome?
Our first instinct was that since we're both curators of various kinds, Trish with film and me with textiles and clothing and other kinds of art and history things, we first thought that what we wanted to do was a kind of traveling exhibition, but that the films and the framework would travel, and that all these different museums would be able to fill in from their own collections, because almost every museum has, you know, blankets and uniforms and things from that were memorial pieces and things like that. Then COVID happened and various other things. And I got a fellowship in 2022 at the National Library in Canberra. And that, I think, really changed our minds. We knew that funding was going to be very difficult for anything else. And we decided we needed to write a book. The other thing that happened during that was that the title of our project changed, which we had always called it Fabric of War, A Hidden History of the Global Wool Trade. And by the end of that, we had done so much more research on the fast fashion and the origins of rayon and synthetic fibers and whatnot, that the title changed to Fleeced.
That's a very good title. And, you know, clearly it hooked me in. I'll say, you know, right now that I'm the daughter of a sheep farmer, and so I was likely to be hooked in as well. But, you know, it doesn't just relate to your experience, both of you. You know, you have both familial connections with people in the wool trade in your ancestry, but also, you know, it obviously, you know, interest in textiles and telling stories through dress and putting these stories together in this form, you know, it must have just been so compelling at that stage to work out that you had so much going on.
We did have so much going on. One of the things that we discovered along the way is that national museums, the NMAH in the US, Te Papa in New Zealand, National Museum and other institutions in Australia, none of them really wanted to do a fully transnational story. And it must be said that the first publishers we spoke to were a bit kind of wary about that too. But actually, Morin, as you probably know, there's actually a thriving genre of books about international textiles, lots of them, but not only about wool. And yes, so in the end, a book just made sense, and it was, you know, it was what we could do.
War.
And we had something after 10 years of research.
You sure did. We'll talk about the research soon, but what about, you know, war as the wool being the fabric of war? Is this something, Madeline, that's been of huge interest to you over the years of your work?
I would say that I've always been fascinated, particularly by World War I, which I've read an awful lot about and still absolutely do not understand. But what really pushed me into this particular focus on wool and war was the exhibition and the book that Trish talked about, which was Homefront and Battlefield. It was a Civil War sesquicentennial exhibition. And my colleague on that project, Lynn Bassett, and I decided to approach it through quilts because, you know, people aren't generally threatened by quilts. So if you can lure people into an exhibition with the prospect of looking at lovely quilts and then smack them in the face with the history, you have a chance to actually get through to people things that they might not otherwise want to understand or know about.
So, you know, what we understand is that, and, you know, you will tell me how it was that in these wars, in particular First World War, Second World War, and the ones Korean War, the fact that the British, the UK, and the US were able to get their hands on the bulk of the wool that was being grown in the world, the global wool trade, gave them a huge advantage. And I think, you know, not many people will, they would know that probably instinctively, but they wouldn't have thought that through.
I mean, one side of that, Maureen, is definitely a document that accompanied my grandfather's letters that's from 1915, and he's going through a Byzantine bureaucratic process to export Australian wool to the US, which is something he's been working with a big US woolen mill for almost a decade already. Anyway, there's kind of all these layers of bureaucracy. Britain, before the US enters the war in April 1917, Britain has considerable doubts about the US, particularly that Australian wool and probably New Zealand wool could be a backdoor to Germany, because Britain has worked so hard to kind of take control of this precious resource. Now, John McGibbon, who you would know is the historian of New Zealand wool industry and who I greatly respect and appreciate his input, John is pretty sure that that's true, that that's happened. Madeline has been deep into the archive in the US and finds no evidence for this at all, that it was, yeah.
Oh, no, that's not exactly true.
Okay. Over to you.
There is, what they were concerned about was the German, the U.S. woolen industry was sort of divided between the German ancestry part in New Jersey and then the Anglo ancestry part in New England. And there is some evidence that up until the time Italy joined the Allies and stopped being neutral, that that there was wool being shipped to Italy and then going to Switzerland and then going in. And that was mostly being bemoaned by the Anglo wool brokers in New England, and not the Germans at all, who were probably terrified of actually, you know, being seen to be on that side. So,
yeah,
the wool trade is really complicated. And the fact that whenever war breaks out, the whole politics of this vital strategic fiber changes, that's, you know, there's a story there.
Oh, and you've made a story of it. But you've actually gone back. I mean, we're talking about World War One, World War Two, but, you know, to acquaint people with wool and sheep and breeds and manufacture and broking and whatever, you've actually gone back to the origins of wool and given people, you know, a quick kind of journey through where sheep came from, how Britain became so renowned, and where it went to, often to the colonies. And, you know, that's all useful information for us to know before you start talking about the trade in, during the war.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thank you, because we talk about that as a gallop through several centuries.
Yes, on the sheep's back.
We also have a gallop through frontier war, of course, mostly in Australia, but also to a degree in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And, there are fascinating similarities but also differences between Maori people and Aboriginal people in relation to wool. But both Maori and Aboriginal people have been huge contributors to our nation's wool industries.
Yes, I like that you brought out. As I said, you tell this, you put this book together in a series of of stories about objects and people. And you, Trish, have brought together the family Tup. Is it Tup or Tub? And her family. Yep. And we have families, similar Māori families here, where there are generations of shearers, rouseys, wool sorters, been part of the shearing gangs that keep the industry going.
I never got to meet her, but Mavis Mullins was very helpful to me on this project, and I, yes, enjoyed talking to her, although I never actually got to interview her. Yeah,
will you bring her through the story too, just to keep reminding us of the rich layers of who has contributed to this? But of course, the story is also to do with the rise of synthetic fibres. And I was utterly intrigued, and it's an extraordinary story of how the Germans had to work to get fibre for their uniforms and for their war effort when they had such limited access to wool. Tell me, or tell us, about that.
Well, Germany in World War I was, and then later again in World War II, but World War I was really the turning point. They were cut off from pretty much everything that they imported by the blockade that the British imposed, and by the British making all of the textile fibers contraband at fairly early on in the war, and blocking as much as they could neutral ships from bringing anything in. And so, I mentioned the Italy-Switzerland overland route at one point was one of the few ways that they managed. The other way they managed was to simply loot the fiber stocks and the textile stocks of every place they occupied during the war, and we can't forget that. But by about early to mid-1916, they were really suffering from shortages. And everything was being really earmarked for the military, and the civilians were really suffering. What they did was they looked for every substitute under the sun. And for the most part, those substitutes at that time were naturally occurring fibers, like the fiber from the stinging nettle, the fiber from a kind of seaweed that's an Australian seaweed called Posidonia. And also grows in New Guinea, which was then under German control. But there were lots of things that they couldn't get simply because they didn't control the seas the way Britain did. So they turned to paper, which they had forests, and they were also getting paper pulp from the Swedes right across the water there. And it seems so bizarre to us that, you would spin a paper, take a strip of like a craft paper, a millimeters wide and endless length, and spin a yarn out of it and then weave fabric. But they were wearing it in civilian suits and girls' underwear, in pajamas and all kinds of things. And what we found was that it wasn't just a civilian thing, that it was also being used in tremendous amounts in varying things by the military. And that is what really stunned me about that. They had nothing. And so that was really one impetus to the interwar push to really develop rayon, which is a semi-synthetic. It's a naturally occurring substance that's made from cellulose, but it is chemically altered in its physical properties to create a yarn. And that was really the beginning of we had to find a substitute for that we have here, because we can't get it from somewhere else.
I must say that it was only along the process of researching this book over a decade, essentially, that we really realized that we were telling the story of where synthetic textiles came from. And remarkably, nobody had done that. It's fascinating. But, you know, the synthetics manufacturers had very deep pockets for marketing. So synthetics certainly got sold very much by companies like DuPont. But, yes, I find it utterly fascinating that nobody has previously written the history of synthetics. Without going too far into it, publishers weren't so interested in that angle. They were happy for it, that angle to be in the book. But it's sort of like synthetics is like this, you know, danger, danger.
Yes, fast fashion and all. Just to finish, and I wish we could talk for much longer about this, but you make a plea, really, to rediscover, because a lot of younger people don't know the wonderful properties of wool, for us to look at wool, buy wool, look after it, repair it, restore it, darn it, do whatever. But that's very much the message of your book at the end, isn't it?
It is. And actually not only wool, you know, I've said too many times that I mostly wear woolen undies these days and love them. But it's not only wool, it's all fibres, including actually, you know, quality synthetic ones. We all need to buy the best quality textiles that we can, natural fibres and synthetics, to look after them, to repair them, to give them the longest life possible, and not to have too much in our closets. I don't know about New Zealand, but Australia and the US are the worst in the world for fast fashion. I'd like to think New Zealand does better on that regard, but I must say I didn't check.
Well, I don't know the details of that, but it's not something to be proud of. Madeline, what would you like to say?
Well, I just, you know, we did look at the numbers of people in the world, which, you know, rises and rises. And we know, you know, that natural fibers cannot clothe the world, the world's population as it currently exists. And that, so yes, synthetic fibers have their place, as do natural fibers. But what Trish said about, you know, buying quality fabrics and buying quality clothing and looking for your style and not just following trends and just changing our relationship completely to how we buy clothes and other kinds of textiles. Nobody needs to change out their curtains in their house every year, you know, or change the duvet cover on their bed, you know, every 6 months. I mean, you just don't need to do that.
Well, thank you both for the huge amount of research you've done into this fascinating topic and for telling it in such a delightful way, you know, through objects, through stories, through people. You've really made the topic come alive. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Maureen. That
thank
means
so
a lot.
Fleeced, Unravelling the History of Wool and War, is written by Trish Fitzsimons and Madeline Shaw, and it's published by Roman and Littlefield.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Kings of This World is the highly anticipated new young adult novel by beloved writer Elizabeth Knox. It's been 12 years since Elizabeth ventured back to Southland, the location of her hugely popular novels Dream Hunter and Mortal Fire. Elizabeth, of course, is renowned for her fantastical novels, her memoirs and essays. She's been awarded just about every prize, award and residency known in New Zealand. She's a Companion of the New Zealand Order of Merit, has received the Prime Minister's Award for Literature, and she is an Arts Laureate. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, absolutely. Southland, you've gone back there, and I know your fans will be thrilled. 12 years, why?
This book took a long time to write, so I had always meant to continue with Southland, and I had an idea about a school in which there were the 1% of this particular country who the pupils kind of represented the people who were able to tell other people what to do, like literally get their orders obeyed, though most of those people really can't do anything like that. They just, you know, can make a bit of a sly suggestion, or, you know, their negging is particularly good, or any of that stuff. But there are one or two people who are, you know, pretty powerful. So I had that idea, and then I was thinking of it as a standalone book, and then I realised it would work really well as a Southland book, and that I had this alternate New Zealand already imagined. And that kind of just freed me up to use as much of my own life and what I knew and the things I cared about, you know, landscapes and observations about streets and the way people behave, and without having to do any of that further invention.
The world building that you're so renowned for.
Yes. Well, I like doing it, but it's one of those things that in certain kinds of fantasy books, a little bit goes a long way. Like, you want to do something that is just a world like our world, but you just change.
You're one tweaking thing. It, aren't you? Yeah. In this world, Southland, the Dreamland. A number of the people have this, I guess it's P, which must...
Power of persuasion.
Power of persuasion. But there's different P words used in there as well. So tell us about that particular attribute that people have.
Well, 1% of the population has... a form of P, which is they have the power to persuade people to do what they want. And with most people like that, it is just a kind of a mild thing. So they can convince the maitre d' to give them the best table at the restaurant, or they can jump queues easily. They can just go, oh, excuse me, and go and stand where they want in a queue. Just little things like that. But then there are people who are a lot stronger, and usually they start off as children not very controlled with what they're able to do, so they tend to be medicated before they reach the age of reason, because they might suddenly persuade their siblings to go out and stand in the snow or something, and yeah, because they're annoyed with them. So in the school, Tybalt Academy, which is the preferred school of the percentage, most of the kids are just, there's a lot of kids with no P, or what gets called no P,
yep,
there. So the no P kids are there because of scholarships, or, you know, things like that. They can play sports particularly well, and the school's recruited them for what they can do. And then there are just kids from P families with P, but there, and they sort of jostle and elbow each other, but there are a few people who can do more than that. And so the protagonist of the book, Vex Magdalene, is one of those people who can do more. She has never been to school before. She has been raised at first in a cult where, when she was 8 years old, everybody in the cult was killed using pee, which has changed the society's attitude to pee over those years. She was, after that, raised in institutions and then in a very good foster family, and has only been allowed to go to a school in her final year of high school. So she's ready and rearing to go, but she's also enormously self-controlled because she's spent her whole life being watched like a smoking volcano.
Now, the relationships that you build amongst the other pupils, this is a group of five, are really pivotal to this book, aren't they?
Yes. This is a friendship story, very much a friendship story. Partly because Vex arrives in Tybalt Academy with this roaring loneliness that she's lived inside for years, and she just really wants to make friends. She isn't kind of a needy, lonely person. She's just she's bold. She's got a lot of courage, emotional courage with people, and a thick skin at the same time. So she kind of just needles and pursues people around, asking them questions and quarrels with them and generally kind of gets under their skin. And the important person is the person she meets before she actually arrives, but she identifies him as a classmate, a to-be classmate, and that's Ari. And Ari has phenomenal pee. It's spooky pee. It's the kind of he can make people see reality differently, but he kind of doesn't know that he can do it, and he's a bit of a loose unit. And this is, of course, enormously interesting to Vex, and so she kind of just makes sure that she becomes involved in his life. She really kind of just elbows into his existence, which I enjoyed doing that because I kind of enjoyed doing a very non-passive young woman, yeah.
Then, of course, the way you've structured it, there's a really quite violent incident that happens to these five, and they're kidnapped. And this happens very early in the book. And so what you're able to do is kind of go from one scenario to the other, from their life at the school getting to know one another, or Vex getting to know them, and then what's going on for them in this awful situation.
Yes, yes. You see Vex forming relationships with them before they're really tested by events, and then you see simultaneously, because there's alternating chapters, what happens when those relationships come under pressure at first, and exactly how much they rise to the occasion. And they really do. They're courageous young people, all in different ways. They react to everything differently, but they coordinate their reactions in a way that means they support each other and you know, in their efforts to escape.
Yeah, they really solidify those bonds. I mean, some of them had them already, but Vex has, you know, worked hard, as you say, to get to know them and test them. And then the rest of the book is them trying to work out who kidnapped them, why they were kidnapped.
Yes.
And so, you know, that's what we want to know at that stage. What on earth was going on to place them in that jeopardy?
Yes, I was kind of interested in writing a story that didn't just end with the crisis resolved, that I wanted to talk about trauma. And I wanted to talk about, I guess, to one side of it, there are the adults, and the adults take over. They, you know, they're either formally running the investigation in the case of the police, or informally in the case of Hanu Kristandi, one of the friends, his billionaire father, who basically just can get what he wants and do what he wants. So they're all investigating, but they don't keep the young people in the loop. They just say, here, have counselling and you're all going to get better and, you know, pretty much like stay out of trouble. And they can't let it go. The kids can't let it go because they can't feel safe. It doesn't matter what happens, they continue to feel unsafe while they still are uncertain about what happened and why it happened. And because of that, they do end up, you know, working towards solving the mystery, but they also put themselves in danger again.
There's a lot of contemporary themes and issues that you're exploring underneath this. I mean, what the adults, the government, the people in control are wanting to do about people who have P and those who don't, and how they're going to regulate it. That has a lot of resonance with what's going on today.
Yes, well, it isn't the classic, just, you know, the persecuted superhuman story, which is a trope, which is a fun trope. It's kind of, I'm interested in the pressure to be morally responsible and to figure out if you're able, if you have talent or you have privilege, what can you do with it in the world for the good of the world? And that's what faces particularly Beats and Ari. They're the ones to who that's a big question. How do they live with what they're able to do? And Beats's answer to that has always been, just don't do it. And, so she has to figure out how to live with her power. I am interested in sort of instrumentality that the people who kidnap the young people, they don't see them as people. They see them as a means to an end, even if it's just their own ego gratification, because they're terrible bullies. And, I'm kind of just interested in that behaviour.
And as I say, there's a lot of bullies around at the moment. There always has been, I guess. They're just out there and very obviously out there.
Yeah, they keep forming collectives.
I know. endless fodder for a writer, absolutely. I learned a new term recently. I'm obviously very behind things. Dark academia, and this is part of it, isn't it? Tell us about that.
Well, when I started writing it, because bearing in mind I did take a long time writing it because I was writing three things at the same time in my usual disorganised fashion. So I was not really aware of it as a genre, but of course during that I became aware of it as a genre and I thought, well, I'm very happy about it fitting into that. My favourite Dark Academia are the Scholomance books by Naomi Novik. Those are just, oh my God, they're so good, so exciting. So, yes.
Well,
I feel like it's a very respectable tradition.
Good. Explain it a little for people like me who didn't understand in the beginning.
Well, yes. Well, Dark Academia is, roughly speaking, books that are set with teenage protagonists in schools, or largely in schools, but the dark is that it's not nice, it's not cozy, it's the opposite of cozy. I mean, everything these days seems to fall into dark or cozy. So it's just, yes, blood is shed and people confront their weaknesses and there are
machinations. Yes,
machinations and so forth.
Well, as somebody who spent 6 years in a boarding school, I can say there was no academia about it, but it was dark at times.
I believe you. I think one of the reasons I wrote the book too was because I went to a large suburban college, you know, co-ed college, and the idea of of a boarding school always had that romance attached to it. So, you know, if you're going to write fantasy, you might as well write your own personal fantasies about, oh, yes, no. God, it wouldn't have been nice to be in boarding school. Because, of course, it wouldn't have been nice to be in boarding school.
No, you would have been bored, witless Elizabeth. But you could have got into your world building, because I love it in this book that Vex, as a young child, is very interested in creating her own worlds and fantasies, but the people she does it with get bored and sort of abandon her. And that...
I was interested in, you know, giving her a crisis when she was a child. Her first crisis is because the people who she's relying on to love the thing that she loves don't love it like she loves it. Yeah, and it's about escaping from herself. That when she's playing her game, she's not in her difficult living situation because her father's the head of the commune, but being in the commune isn't easy for anyone in the commune, really.
Yeah, and
cult, it's... The cult.
The cult, yeah. Well, you've touched on so many interesting things, and young adults are going to be absorbed by it. Is Vex somebody that you want to write about again, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I have a plan. Yes,
I've got
two more Southland books to write. One of them predates all of the other ones. I'm kind of consolidating some ideas about the different magics in Southland. And then the last one has Vex and the other, her friends, Ari and Tay and Ronnie and Hanu, some years later.
Well, hurry out and get yourself Kings of This World by Elizabeth Knox. It's published by Allen and Unwin. And it's not just for young adults. It's for everybody who loves this kind of writing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Lucy O'Hagan is a Pākehā GP with many years' experience working across the full spectrum of Aotearoa communities, including those surviving the roughest hands dealt by our social inequalities. She writes openly, chattily mining her heart and her own life experience to explore empathy as a human and as a professional responsibility. The doctor, poet, and health equality activist Glenn Colquhoun, I'm not quite sure how to say his name, but Lucy will correct me, no doubt, describes her memoir as a prescription that will help us all find better ways to be in our society. Read it, then call me in the morning, he says. It is very much a medicine in itself. I'd describe it as a profound meditation on practicing your profession with soul. Tēnā koe, Lucy. Thanks for joining us.
Tēnā koe, that was beautiful.
So how do I say Glenn's surname?
We just say Kahuna, I think.
Kahuna.
I say the Q silent.
Okay, thank you, Kahuna. Yeah. I'll know that next time. Sorry, Glenn, if you're listening. Lucy, can you tell listeners about the place and the community within which you practice currently and the team that you work with?
Oh, yeah. So I currently work for Auditor Cannons Creek, which is in East Porirua, so it's 86% Pacifica Māori, and it's one of the practices owned by Ngāti Toa, who are the tangata whenua in Porirua. So they're really fantastic to work for because they're about the people. And it's really interesting as a Pākehā pārangi being in that environment because, you know, of course, we're up against ourselves. You know, what's my culture and what's my assumptions about the way things should be or the way you should conduct your life or what health is. You know, I think we talk about health outcomes, but what we're actually talking about is medical outcomes, because in some ways the medical outcomes where I am are very bad, but the health is actually pretty good. There's a collective way of being that is very compelling to see. You know, old people looked after at home, disabled children looked after at home, in the sense of the collective wrapping around in a way that, for me as a middle-class Pākehā in a sort of individualistic world, is quite, it's very moving.
The book conveys a rich and a really nuanced, loving portrait of that and of all of the humanity in each of your encounters as a GP, actually. So sometimes it must be really hard to stay open-hearted. And so I'm fascinated to hear you describe what you take out of your work that sustains that ability to stay open-hearted.
I think it's actually harder if you're not open-hearted, actually. I think that is really hard because it's taking this position where you don't judge anything you're told. That is sort of a treatment in itself because you might be dealing with people who've been judged their entire lives. So for someone as powerful as a Pākehā doctor to come along and sit alongside a story and not judge it and just that's a treatment. And if you... Otherwise, you were saying, oh, I have to do something else. But actually, that is doing something. And I think it's very powerful. It's very powerful when we can do that. It's about working with people who are the most disenfranchised. You know, people in and out of prison, living in boarding houses, living on the street. The people who we would consider the bottom of the heap. Honestly, sometimes they're way wiser than the people we think of at the top, but we won't go there. And so it's about seeing the strengths in those people, that they actually keep going, given what they've been dealt in life, instead of creating a series of deficits that they have, because that's part of it. And so if you do that and then... you see the strengths and you find the hope, and you can't convey hope unless you have it. So you have to do some internal thing in your head and heart that actually sees it. Then what you're doing is empowering the person to actually witness their own story with compassion, but also to see that there's a way forwards and that they're actually all really doing an amazing job just getting up in the morning.
Yeah, kia ora.
You know, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to know was who's the book primarily written for, Lucy? And I guess I know that it takes you a whole book to do it, but could you summarise what you wanted them to take out of reading your book?
I really want to communicate those ideas in a way that anyone can access. That so some of the pieces were originally written for a doctor audience. So I worked quite hard to try and make them not feel like I'm talking to doctors because people are actually interested. I mean, people who aren't doctors are actually interested in the culture of doctors because they interact with doctors and they're quite a confusing bunch of people and they can be really weird and, you know, and a bit odd and tricky to deal with. Yeah. I love the way doctors talk about patients as being tricky, but actually doctors are quite tricky.
You've got a lovely chapter in there about which kind of doctor do I want to show up and see. You know, sometimes I want to see this doctor. So that kind of really goes to that idea that it's not a single kind of culture across the profession, is it? There's different ways of being a doctor.
Oh, well, I have this fascinating job where I teach GP trainees, and for the last 4 years I've been watching 150 consultations a year about, and either real consultations with patients in the room or on video, or we do role plays with actors, and it's astounding watching. It doesn't really matter what sort of person they are. They can be just completely different people. Some of them might be very serious and earnest, but when they're just being who they are, it just becomes sort of magic, and then the magic starts to happen.
On the there's this idea of this kind of systemic dehumanising of medicine in the book, like this idea of kind of atomising everything, and GPs are only dealing with a body, and it's the kaiāwhina who's supposed to deal with the heart or the So in yourself, do you think that we're better at practicing medicine or worse, and how do you than we used to be in as general practice in particular?
Well, I think in some ways we're better at it. I think that there's been some huge shifts in my career in terms of, I mean, one of the shifts is in the, you know, the Māori and Pacifica GPs that have come through who are completely live in two cultural worlds, speak different languages, and they've sort of transformed our way of thinking about consultations, because of course our models were developed in Canada and the UK, so they're very Eurocentric and they're fantastic, like really good skill kind of development. But then when you bring that into an Aotearoa context, then how does that look? And so they've pushed us into, you know, whakawhanaungatanga, what is that even, what is that? What does that look like? What does a pro-equity practitioner look like in a consultation? And so, yeah, that's been amazing. I think general practice is changing a lot. But I think for me, it's about what happens in the room. The problem at the moment is that the health service is so fragile that what's happening in the room is really hard, because one of the things that's really hard is that if you haven't got any appointments for 6 weeks, then you're really under pressure to deal with all the things the person's bringing. And that's really hard on you, because usually in the past you go, let's do this, and then for this thing we'll do this test and then come back next Tuesday, or I'll ring you next Tuesday. But we can't do that now. We have to. This is terrible pressure. So I think there's real, you know, there are real sort of issues in the health service that are actually impacting what happens in the room. But I do think there's a room for a lot of innovation as well. But what I think is important when there's all these threats on the health service is that we actually are very clear what our values are. Because it's very easy for the things that are taken away are actually those human things, because there's not enough time to do them. And that's the thing you don't want to take away. Because the thing is, it's like I get measured on things like, did I take everyone's blood pressure? Did I weigh everyone? And honestly, in some consultations, that is so meaningless. Mm. Like, that is not what it's about. But the things that happen that are meaningful aren't measured and no one sees them. And I think that's part of the reason for writing this book, is to sort of show how important those things are. Mm. And I think for GPs, when I tell those stories, and I've read some of them at conferences, in fact, I've read the one about an apologetic defence of my longer consultations, and I think they feel seen, GPs, because they're alone in a room all day with people, and there's some bureaucrat out there saying, well, you haven't done enough cardiovascular risk assessments, and we're going, yeah, well, maybe, but, you know, there's a lot going on in this room that you don't even, you know.
Yeah, you do a beautiful satire of the chawa chip, I think, which is a non-existing tool but sounds so much like so many health tools that are out there in the world, and the reality of trying to do it with somebody who's experiencing trauma and mental health
issues.
Well,
we love counting things and measuring things.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's useful, but they may not actually be the most important things, and they can become a distortion. So if you think about a patient's story, and then you try to reduce that to 25 yes, no questions, it's kind of ridiculous, really, isn't it? It's like all the nuance is gone, and all of the seeing the strengths in it and seeing the, I mean, it gets as ridiculous as there was a line last night in the performance, which is, have you got any hobbies? It's like, you know, it's kind of ridiculous,
yeah,
really, to have pre-formatted sort of questions that people fill in. Anyway,
I'm struck by your story of burnout, okay, and by this balance, the between like the personal cost of practicing with soul, in a system that doesn't kind of really recognise that work, versus the cost of not doing it. What we lose as a society, but also as a health professional, if you try and just practice in that way, what's lost is the joy of the practice. So, and I think you get to the heart of that in the book, but I wonder whether you just could describe a little bit about your burnout and what you saw really as the roots of that in terms of practice and I guess you ultimately in your own life as well, like that finding balance as a GP in the system under pressure.
Well, I think that my burnout was kind of like it is a really hard job to do, and I don't think we've got a lot of clarity as a profession on how to manage the big stories that we hear. Our only sort of solution is this concept of self-care, which is this kind of nebulous idea that somewhere outside of work you'll do yoga and go for a run and then you'll be really lovely and okay. And actually it's way more complicated than that, because I think it's what happens in the room that means that I end up carrying the story, or I leave it with the patient who has already been carrying the story, and hopefully as they go out the door they feel a bit more empowered and it feels a bit lighter, but I can't carry it for them. So how do we do that? I actually think it's in there that that we have to do something, and it's really about managing yourself in that and kind of grounding the energy of it and seeing the strengths in the person and seeing all those things so that they are going out the door feeling a little bit lighter, or as I said in one of the stories, perhaps with their tail wagging.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have said that's a terrible metaphor because a patient's not a dog, but actually, you know, the tail wagging is the gold standard visual metaphor for well-being, isn't it? And so if you can get it a little bit more wagging, then I think you've done your job. I mean, of course, you're doing all the medicine as well, but sometimes there's very little medicine. Sometimes there's a lot of story and a little bit of medicine, and the medicine might not even be wanted.
Yeah.
So it depends on your situation, but I'm talking about the situations where the medicine isn't such a big factor in the consultation.
Did you do any tail wagging in your performance at your book launch last night, Lucy?
I think so.
You sound like you might have been wagging a lot yourself through the celebration of getting this book to its audience.
It's amazing, because I didn't know who was coming. And so these people from my life just appeared through the door. It was absolutely fantastic. And then in the middle of all that, I did this performance, because I used to do quite a bit of acting. And I've made this really, it's actually technically very tricky performance, because I'm doing multiple characters and changing character very rapidly. So it's quite... There was a little bit of ad-libbing and there were a few asides to get me through where I'd forgotten things or left a patient in the waiting room. My partner who was doing the very low-level tech became nurse. Who have we – who's next, nurse? Just like – anyway, I managed to sort of pull it off. But it was really – it's quite an interesting performance. Because it's a bit like the book, it's quite multi-layered, including like just about the variety of people. Because I think when you go to a doctor, you think that other people that go to the doctor are the same as you and they behave the same way and they should be like you and they think about health like you. But, no. We have the full variety of humanity.
I think that is one of the wonderful gifts of being in general practice, isn't it? Just seeing that full spectrum of humanity and being a bit kind of witnessing that. And you do a beautiful, beautiful job of bearing witness to that and respect for that and love for that in the book. Mm-hmm. We run out of time, Lucy. I really wanted to talk with you about creativity for health practitioners, because there's something that's been such a big part of your life, and vision and hope we didn't get to, but I think everything about you speaks to that. So thank you so much, Dr. Lucy O'Hagan. Your work is a blessing on us all. And the book is Everything But the Medicine, A Doctor's Tale. It's published by Massey Press.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.